From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
For the first time in 15 years, we are debating the congressional role in the declaration of war.
That was Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky speaking in the U.S. Senate Wednesday during debate over his attempt to put an end to the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and five other places by amending the authorization for the use of military force, which was passed a week after the September 11th attacks 16 years ago.
We have fought the longest war in U.S. history under an original authorization to go after the people who attacked us on 9/11. That war is long since over. The war has long since lost its purpose. And it's long time that we have a debate in Congress about whether we should be at war or not. It is the constitutional role of Congress. Interestingly, the folks that you have heard on either side of the issue have said it is our job. It is what we should be doing. And yet we haven't done it for 16 years. Who in their right mind thinks that Congress is actually going to do their job without being forced to do their job? My resolution is actually silent on whether we should still be at war. My resolution just simply says that the resolutions that we have previously passed will expire. I don't believe they have anything to do with the seven wars we're involved with currently anyway. But if we were to force them to expire, we would then have a debate. But for those who say, yes, Congress should exert its authority, Congress should be involved in the initiation of war, they don't really believe that unless they're going to vote that way. What will happen is the continuation of the same, that we abdicate that role and let the president do whatever he wants. It's worse than that. Let's say we were to vote for my resolution and that the authorization to go to war after 9/11 expired. Do you think any of the wars would end? No, the neoconservatives and the neoliberals believe the president has unlimited authority. They call it Article II authority for war. There is some authority given to the president. It's an enormous amount of authority to execute the war, but not to initiate war. The sole duty of initiation of war was given specifically to Congress. So if these authorities were to expire, the president already says, I have all the authority I want under the Constitution to do whatever I want. But that's not what our founders wanted. Madison, if he were here, would vehemently disagree. Madison wrote that the executive branch is the branch most prone for war. Therefore, the Constitution, with studied care, vested that power in the legislature. It was supposed to be difficult to go to war. And some gnash their hands and say, oh, Senate could never agree on any authorization to go to war. You know how long it took us after Pearl Harbor? 24 hours and we declared war on Japan. You know how long it took us after 9/11? 3 days.
Paul's proposed amendment failed by a vote Wednesday of 61 to 36. RT's Caleb Maupin has more.
Each year, the U.S. Congress passes the National Defense Authorization Act, which supplies funding and authorization to the U.S. military for the following year. Now, in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, the National Defense Authorization Act began to start having a section of it added to it that was called the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. This essentially allowed the United States to carry out military force in the fight against terrorism. Now, U.S. Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, who is a noted opponent and critic of intervention by the U.S. military around the world, put forward an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act that would remove this section. It would remove the authorization of military force, which has been present for the last 16 years as part of the NDAA. He would have removed it, and essentially his removal would have required the U.S. to start bogging down and restricting its foreign involvement around the world. It would have restricted the war on terror and essentially not allowed the United States and the commander-in-chief, the president, to continue authorizing and carrying out these military interventions. Now, not surprisingly, it was voted down, even though there was quite a bit of anticipation in the lead-up to the vote. As the votes in the U.S. Senate went down, it was 61 against, 36 in favor. Now, Rand Paul has said that he intends to make a bigger deal out of this. There's talk of potentially a filibuster. He's tweeted out a great deal of frustration, saying, where is the anti-war left demanding that the wars end? Where are the constitutional conservatives demanding the right of Congress to reclaim the war powers? 16 years, this National Defense Authorization Act has included the authorization for the use of military force, and each year it has been passed. Now we're seeing Rand Paul demanding that it be removed, but he has been voted down, and it looks like the National Defense Authorization Act will proceed to go to the House of Representatives without this amendment proposed by Rand Paul.
But despite the Senate's refusal to put an end to the seven wars in which the U.S. is currently engaged, one of those may be coming to an end on its own, having been won on the battlefield by Syria's military with the assistance of Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. For more on this, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international relations at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow Thursday.
In the last week, just over a week, the Syrian Arab Army, backed by its allies, Iran, Hezbollah, and the Russian Air Force and some small number of Russian special forces, sappers units and the like, have managed to liberate Deir ez-Zor in central east Syria. Deir ez-Zor is a city of some 100,000 to 200,000 people that has been under siege, almost unreported by the Western press, for 5 years. That's 2 years by al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, the one allied, or still allied today, with what were until the Trump administration took power, U.S.-backed, quote, moderate, unquote, rebels. And then the last 3 years, it's been under siege by ISIS. And this is a critical city for control of East Syria. East Syria is largely desert. The principal thing of value, other than, of course, the highways linking trade with Iraq and the rest of the region, are the oil fields. This is where most of Syria's oil fields are located. But it is sparsely populated. Deir ez-Zor is the largest city in the east, other than Raqqa. Control of it has long prevented U.S. plans for partition of all of East Syria. There have been two or possibly three occasions where U.S. coalition aircraft attacked Syrian government forces defending Deir ez-Zor, either during or directly before an ISIS attempt to overrun the city.
Right.
Now, of course, does the U.S. want ISIS to control Deir ez-Zor? In the long term, no, of course not. Not even in the medium term. What they want is ISIS to take over the city so that then they can take over the city from ISIS and hand it over to their proxies.
Right.
And this is the way that the U.S. has used ISIS. And this is open admission of Barack Obama, John Kerry, each of them on separate occasions, one referring to al-Qaeda and the other referring to ISIS, said, we knew they were getting stronger. We let them grow because they were presenting a bigger threat to the Syrian government. And Russia has long made this accusation, Putin, that they intended to use ISIS and al-Qaeda, not because they wanted ISIS and al-Qaeda necessarily to control, but because they wanted to use them as a battering ram to knock down the Syrian government, you know, as useful idiots, as proxies. So then their more PC proxies, the ones that they were, however incredulously, able to label as moderates, to brand as moderates, could then come in and take control of these areas. So this is the same fictional scenario that in different ways we've seen in Libya and Egypt and Iraq and across the region. The idea that if we regime change a current government, no matter what, and Ukraine as well,
Yep.
No matter what the consistency, how whether it's jihadis, Islamists, Banderite fascists, ultranationalists, no matter how distasteful these proxies, these useful idiots can be, after they've accomplished their primary mission of removing the state, then we can install the liberal government, or at least the compliant government that we want, on top of that. And that has never worked. It has never worked going back to Afghanistan and Yemen in the 80s. It is a failed, moralist, bankrupt, despicable foreign policy that has led to so much suffering and so much death, in complete contravention of all international and domestic law all around the world, and at no small U.S. taxpayer expense.
By the way,
we know that the CIA, from the Washington Post reporting a few years ago, this was leaked, quite openly, seemingly willingly by the Obama administration to indicate that they were doing something. The CIA has funded has salaried, armed, and trained sectarian militants allied and embedded with Al-Qaeda for years to a tune of $1 billion a year.
Right.
The Pentagon's train and equip programs, which were seemingly almost designed to fail. The Pentagon didn't like working with the jihadis as much as the CIA did.
Right.
But their chosen proxies were the Kurds. And the Kurds, albeit, they deserve a little bit of credit because despite enormous U.S. Pressure, they never openly turned on the Syrian government. And they have cooperated with them on occasions, although now we're finally at the end game, when these may be the last two players, at least in East Syria, and that's the new conflict that is brewing. And we've even seen multiple, for years, CIA Islamist proxies allied with Al-Qaeda battling Pentagon Kurdish proxies, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces. So this city, Deir ez-Zor, has been crucial to control of East Syria. And without it, it becomes very problematic for the U.S. to partition all of East Syria, and particularly control of the oil fields, which they would like for their Kurdish proxies rather than for the Syrian government to keep it, in poverty.
Right.
Never mind that none of this is illegal. The U.S. has no international or domestic legal arguments to present for their presence in Syria. Everything they're doing is in contravention of international law. The only way they can legally operate, the only way anyway can legally operate in Syria, is with the permission and with the cooperation of the UN-recognized Syrian government. No matter how much they don't like that government in the West, that is irrespective of international law.
That's right. And, you mentioned something that's very interesting as well. You have Obama and others making open admission, of using the ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Those are public admissions.
They've also admitted, both Biden and Clinton, that Saudi Arabia and Qatar were openly arming both ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban and Boko Haram, for that matter. And the U.S. intelligence knows it.
Right.
And yes, they continue to arm Saudi Arabia with hundreds of billions of dollars of arms.
Record amounts of arms, actually.
Record amounts of arms under both Obama, and now continuing despite the headlines, to a lesser extent under Trump. And they invited Saudi Arabia and Qatar into their so-called anti-ISIS coalition, knowing that they are arming, salarying, and training ISIS and Al-Qaeda directly. Right. The U.S. at least has always kept one implausible degree of separation. They've simply allied their moderate Islamists, who are allied and embedded with the much larger Al-Qaeda, serving as the conduit to get supplies and weapons to them, the special weapons units using tow weapons and so on. And the same thing. They don't arm ISIS and Al-Qaeda directly. They also go via Saudi Arabia, who then arms ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
You have these guys. The U.S.-backed ones, say, have the tow weapons. You have the U.S. Air Force and NATO, whoever, bombing the Syrian army. And then you have the ground troops, ISIS and whomever. It's clear that all the moving parts, the objective is, and at some location somewhere, there are some generals that are sitting down and actually planning all of this. The objective is to take out the Syrian Arab army and hand the country over to someone else so that they can then go in and take it. The geopolitical context is the thing I want to get to, because, on the one hand, You know, they want to take it and put in someone more compliant. But what does that mean? When we look at Libya, for example, almost immediately after taking out Gaddafi, who was the Pan-Africanist of standing with a huge, you know, bankroll and plan to bankroll the unification or the development of Africa, when they took him out, you instead had within a year and a half 35 countries in AFRICOM when you had zero at the beginning of that operation. That was a major geopolitical shift. And so you have to look at what's happening in Syria in that context as well.
Yeah, sure. Libya had other, of course, the control of the oil by European companies, the destabilization of Mali, which led to French forces going in to stabilize Mali, Libya devolving into a warlord, terrorist, ISIS, and Al-Qaeda-controlled failed state. I mean, Libya was destroyed, which continues to this day, and the backlash of the flood of refugees from Africa through Libya, including Libya. And others from across Africa into Europe, which Gaddafi warned would happen.
Right. And which, by the way, served some other geopolitical goals, or at least some folks benefited from that politically in Europe. So how does it look going forward on the ground in Syria? Are we close to an end of the war there?
No. We the end of the war is in sight. The Syrian Arab Army has largely won. You know, with the benefit of its allies. In that, the Islamist and jihadist rebels are now kept kind of in a reserve in Idlib for the moment, where Saudi and Qatari-backed rebels are still basically fighting each other for control of the territory. And the Western mainstream pretty oppressed, however, reluctantly acknowledges that Al-Qaeda is simply – or Idlib simply is Al-Qaeda. It is an Al-Qaeda stronghold from beginning to end. Whether – how much control Ahrar al-Sham has, they've been driven largely out of Idlib. They're just an Al-Qaeda splinter group. They've got largely the same theology and ideology – Wahhabist theology and ideology. Turkey has control of a large stretch of north-central Syria across the Turkish border, which they have shown no signs that they are withdrawing. From. They illegally invaded under the pretext of fighting ISIS and the Kurds, the U.S.-backed Kurds. This is a NATO member. Right. You know, the contradictions here. And they have announced once again, they've announced this before, that they are building a new Syrian national army under their control, the basis of which will be Ahrar al-Sham. And Ahrar al-Sham, again, is a Wahhabist al-Qaeda splinter group.
Right.
So that's not going away. Turkey and Idlib, and there is plenty of cooperation between the two of them, Al-Qaeda-controlled Idlib and Turkey, because, of course, those Al-Qaeda gets supplied at least through Turkey and then, of course, with some Turkey assistance as well as Saudi, Qatar, and whoever else through the Turkish borders. Otherwise, they would collapse immediately. They have to get logistics. They have to get arms. They have to get food because, of course, the areas under their control produce almost nothing. Right. They have to sustain the civilian population at least to a subsistence level, you know, and that has to happen through Turkey. It has always happened to happen in the north of Syria through Turkey. And then we come to northeast Syria, which is under the control of largely the Kurds with a few token Arab tribes that fell afoul of ISIS. Some of them did oppose them from the beginning. Others had political falling outs while ISIS was there and then switched sides. And this is branded as the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces. And there was just this. The Pentagon has long been backing the Kurds. And although it does seem that the CIA, the Obama CIA arming of the Islamist allied with Al-Qaeda, in the central and west of the country has ended, the funding of the Kurds has increased and increased to heavy weapons. And there was just reported in the last few days in such places as Zero Hedge and Foreign Policy, if you want something more mainstream, that it has been exposed through leaked Pentagon documents that the Pentagon is now funding the Kurds to a tune of some $2.2 billion of arms, most of it coming from ex-Soviet countries. This has long been happening, of course, but this is documented proof of it. And it's all connected in the trade with organized crime, networks in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, in Georgia, in Moldova, in Serbia, Romania, Bulgaria. There's also weapons from all of these areas going into Ukraine as well, the same type of ex-Soviet weapons. And the paperwork, the Pentagon is trying to cover up the paperwork for this. They're trying to erase it. And this documents were, I guess, leaked to expose that. $2.2 billion U.S. taxpayer dollars just, you know, in the recent term.
Jeez.
So the U.S., the Trump administration officials keep insisting when pressed directly on the matter that their only goal now, as Trump campaigned on in Syria, is to fight ISIS. And they have no specific plans after that. When they're not being directly pressed on it, they talk about all the same kind of nation building and establishing local councils of their proxies and so on to rule the country that Trump decried during his campaign, the nation building, the regime change that he said that he was against. But it's largely acknowledged that Trump really doesn't have any control of his foreign and military policy, that it's McMaster's and Mattis and others that are now running the foreign policy and military policy of the United States. So he doesn't really have any say anymore, power as far as I'm concerned, or as Russia is concerned.
Yeah.
But the proxies, the Kurds, the SDF, and it has to be remembered that the SDF is largely composed of the PKK, the anarcho-Marxists. And this is completely at odds with U.S. allied Iraq, which is moving ever, ever closer through this conflict to Syria and to Russia and Iran, and with NATO member Turkey, who both don't want to see an independent Kurdish state established because of the threat to their own territorial integrity and sovereignty. They both have large Kurdish minority populations. Iran does as well, although it has to be said the Kurds are not a monolith. They all, in different areas, they all have political differences. But the U.S. government, you know, the Trump administration, a populist right-wing government, you know, with a few interesting deviations from the right-wing norm on foreign policy and trade, is arming anarcho-Marxists to partition, to effectively partition and whatever East Syria illegally. And no matter what they say, their proxies keep insisting that the Syrian government will never establish re-control over these areas, that they will prevent that. So this is the coming confrontation looming, and there's three of them. This is the most immediate one making the headlines. This is with the U.S.-backed Kurdish proxies in the northeast, but also with the Turks and their proxies in central Syria, and their closely connected Al-Qaeda, HTS, as it's now known under the acronym, controlling all of Idlib province. So those are the three brewing confrontations. The primary battle, ISIS is dead. ISIS, it's just a matter of the race to take ISIS-controlled territory. Whoever can then owns that going into the final either political settlement or conflict.
Right. Yeah,
because that's what we're looking at,
and that conflict,
we don't know where it's going to break.
And that conflict might be sides, United States on one side and Russia on another. In other words,
it's very possibly be. My mind is that the Russian government doesn't have as much problem with the Kurds. So them and the Syrian government have actually armed, supplied, and provided close air support with the Kurds and cooperated them with at various junctures. Some small skirmishes have occurred, of course. But and there are different Kurdish factions even within Syria. The Western cantons under Afrin in the West are more allied with the Syrian government and Russia, while the ones in the East that have been receiving supplies from more supplies from the U.S. are more allied with the U.S. But I think Russia thinks it does not see Kurds as a terrorist or existential, you know, a security threat to southern Russia up through the Caucasus, like it saw Islamists and jihadis of whatever stripe. And I think that Russia believes that at the end they can cut a deal. Their problem is with the U.S. Using them as leverage.
Yeah.
And the U.S. certainly is. And the U.S. is destroying its own relations with Turkey and Iraq in the process, who are no big fans of this. There are multiple possible new vectors of war breaking out. Russia has actually kept Turkey restrained and cooperated with the U.S. on two occasions in order to do it, transfers of territory from the SDF to the Syrian government to prevent the Turks from advancing into the east against the Kurds. But that's a potential conflict. This is a more open inter-NATO conflict. Iraq is already involved. Iran is involved. This could yet possibly blow up. I have some cautious optimism at this point that it will be settled politically instead. But this is a very tense moment. Russian and U.S., special forces, trainers, some small numbers of troops, a few thousand on both sides, are with their allied, proxies, if you want to call the Syrian government a client state of Russia. You know, that's an argument that can be made, although I wouldn't make it. That they are staring at each other in the face, and they are racing for control of territory. And accidents can happen. They've already happened.
Yeah.
If we want to call them accidents on multiple occasions, right. They can happen again. And it's a very tense moment, and everyone needs to keep their eye on this. Just recently, in the last few days, NGO has brought a lawsuit against they brought it a while ago, but it's coming to prominence now, a lawsuit against the Trump administration demanding the legal rationale for their airstrikes on the Syrian airport because of the reported incident in al-Qaeda-controlled Khan Shaykhun, where the West claims that chemical weapons were used on al-Qaeda, although I find no evidence of this whatsoever. So I fully support this, of course, because there is no legal rationale, and the Trump administration is floundering and not providing any real answer. It's making a few small headlines, at least. But of course, then the question is, where was this org when Obama was arming al-Qaeda allies? Where were they when Obama was destroying Libya? Where were they when Obama was assassinating thousands around the world extrajudicially and extraterritorially with his flying murder machine drones?
Right.
Or where was he when the U.S. was backing a putsch that overthrew a democratically elected government with a vanguard of Banderite fascists and ultranationalists?
Right.
The backing of a coup, of which, you know, call it a coup, putsch, however you like. I prefer putsch. It's more accurate, I believe. But it is against not only international law, but U.S. domestic law as well.
Yeah. There are even more contradictions. At the same time that all of this is going on, for example, with Turkey, Russia just announced the sale of S-400s to them.
In my mind, this is a huge mistake. I mean, in case the Mad Sultan decides to shoot down Russian airplanes again, now he has a choice of using U.S. F-15s or right. Russia's own S-400s super advanced air defense system.
You know, which, my own paranoia.
Turkey was obviously suitably impressed by
it. Yeah, my own paranoia. I imagine, some mechanics and scientists from Boeing and other places dismantling it. So how does this thing work?
Yeah, right. The NATO will now have, of course, complete access to the S-400 system if they didn't already.
Right.
They now completely will. I know the idea behind it is driving a wedge between Turkey and NATO. The West doesn't even apologize for NATO in Turkey anymore. They just try to continue on because they can't risk geopolitically losing it.
Right.
But they have no love for what's going on in Turkey, if only primarily because a lot of it is sentiment, political sentiment, Islamist sentiment directed against them.
Yeah. And then you have... let's see, the other moving parts. You've got more troop transfers into Poland, the effort to have the EU allow NATO troops to move across borders without the affirmative consent of the new host countries. And,
The U.S. just moved two new tank brigades in to Gdansk, and it's moving them in right now to supplement the four NATO brigades that are already now permanently stationed, although they're rotating new ones in and out to try to pretend like they're adhering to previous treaties. But these two new tank brigades, it was rather interesting. The major in charge of these supplemental brigades was asked on camera by Ruptly, what is the threat that U.S. forces there on behalf of NATO supposedly are there? What type of threat could he characterize it? And he said, live on camera, frankly, I have no idea what the threat is.
Jesus, I know. I mean, they've got if you go back to Operation Barbarossa, for example, you had a mobilization that actually, I think, In many ways, particularly including, of course, the power of the weaponry, is larger, not in terms of manpower, but in terms of materiel and in terms of effective manpower, given the additional tools, than Hitler massed. I mean, the destructive power of what's being massed near the Russian border makes what Hitler threw at the Soviet Union look like almost like a holiday, a parade or something.
So I hope I can come on in the next week to spend another half an hour discussing the Russian Zapad military exercises and NATO's military exercises, because that's a whole nother front of the new great game going on.
Yeah, absolutely true. Mark, yeah, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Take care, man. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.